Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We have reached book two of Leo Tolstoy's epic, and I think we should all be quite proud of that. I'm not going to waste any time. Let's hop into book two, chapter one of War and Peace. In October 1805, a Russian army was occupying the villages and towns of the Archduchy of Austria, and yet other regiments freshly arriving from Russia were settling near the fortress of Braunau and burdening the inhabitants on whom they were quartered. Braunau was the headquarters of the commander-in-chief, Kutuzov. On October 11th, 1805, one of the infantry regiments that had just reached Braunau had halted half a mile from the town, waiting to be inspected by the commander-in-chief. Despite the un-Russian appearance of the locality and surroundings, fruit gardens, stone fences, tiled roofs, and hills in the distance, and despite the fact that the inhabitants, who gazed with curiosity at the soldiers, were not Russians, the regiment had just the appearance of any Russian regiment preparing for an inspection anywhere in the heart of Russia. On the evening of the last day's march, an order had been received that the commander-in-chief would inspect the regiment on the march. Though the words of the order were not clear to the regimental commander, and the question arose whether the troops were to be in marching order or not, it was decided at a consultation between the battalion commanders to present the regiment in parade order, on the principle that it is always better to bow too low than not bow low enough. So the soldiers, after a 20-mile march, were kept mending and cleaning all night long without closing their eyes. While the adjutant and company commanders calculated and reckoned, and by morning the regiment, instead of the straggling, disorderly crowd it had been on its last march the day before, presented a well-ordered array of 2,000 men, each of whom knew his place and his duty, had every button and every strap in place, and shone with cleanliness. And not only externally was all in order, but had it pleased the commander-in-chief to look under the uniforms, he would have found on every man a clean shirt, and in every knapsack the appointed number of articles, all, soap and all. As the soldiers say, there was only one circumstance concerning which no one could be at ease. It was the state of the soldiers' boots. More than half the men's boots were in holes. But this defect was not due to any fault of the regimental commander, for in spite of repeated demands, boots had not been issued by the Austrian commissariat, and the regiment had marched some 700 miles. The commander of the regiment was an elderly, choleric, stout and thick-set general with grizzled eyebrows and whiskers, and wider from chest to back than across the shoulders. He had on a brand new uniform, showing the creases where it had been folded, and thick gold epaulets which seemed to stand, rather than lie down, on his massive shoulders. He had the air of a man happily performing one of the most solemn duties of his life. He walked about in front of the line and at every step pulled himself up, slightly arching his back. It was plain to see that the commander admired his regiment, rejoiced in it, and that his whole mind was engrossed by it. Yet his strut seemed to indicate that besides military matters, social interests and the fair sex occupied no small part of his thoughts. "Well, Michael Mitrick, sir," he said, addressing one of the battalion commanders, who smilingly pressed forward. It was plain that they both felt happy. "We had our hands full last night. However, I think the regiment is not a bad one, eh?" The battalion commander perceived the jovial irony and laughed. "It would not be turned off the field even on the Sarsen meadow." "What?" asked the commander. At that moment, on the road from the town in which signallers had been posted, two men approached on horseback. They were an aide-de-camp followed by a Cossack. The aide-de-camp was sent to confirm the order which had not been clearly worded the day before, namely that the commander-in-chief wished to see the regiment just in the state in which it had been on the march, in their great coats and packs and without any preparation whatever. A member of the Hofkriegsgraf from Vienna had come to Kutuzov the day before with proposals and demands for him to join up with the army of the Archduke Ferdinand and Mack, and Kutuzov, not considering this junction advisable, meant, among other arguments in support of his view, to show the Austrian general the wretched state in which the troops arrived from Russia. With this object he intended to meet the regiment, so the worse the condition it was in, the better pleased the commander-in-chief would be. Though the aide-de-camp did not know these circumstances, he nevertheless delivered the definite order that the men should be in their great coats and in marching order, and that the commander-in-chief would otherwise be dissatisfied. On hearing this, the regimental commander hung his head silently, shrugged his shoulders, and spread out his arms with a choleric gesture. "A fine mess we've made of it," he remarked. "There now, didn't I tell you, Michael Mitrick, that it was said, on the march, it meant in the greatcoats," said he reproachfully to the battalion commander. "Oh, my God," he added, stepping resolutely forward. "Company commanders," he shouted in a voice accustomed to command, "sergeant majors, how soon will he be here?" he asked the aide-de-camp with a respectful politeness, evidently relating the personage he was referring to. "In an hour's time, I should say." "Shall we have time to change clothes?" "I don't know, General." The regimental commander, going up to the line himself, ordered the soldiers to change into their great coats. The company commanders ran off to their companies. The sergeant majors began bustling. The great coats were not in very good condition, and instantly the squares that had up to then been in regular order and silent began to sway and stretch and hum with voices. On all sides, soldiers were running to and fro, throwing up their knapsacks with a jerk of their shoulders and pulling the straps over their heads, unstrapping their overcoats and drawing the sleeves on with upraised arms. In half an hour, all was again in order, only the squares had become grey instead of black. The regimental commander walked up with his jerky steps to the front of the regiment and examined it from a distance. "Whatever is this?" "This!" he shouted and stood still. "Commander of the third company?" "Commander of the third company wanted by general. Commander to the general. Third company to the commander." The words passed along the lines, and an adjutant ran to look for the missing officer. When the eager but misrepeated words had reached their destination in a cry of, "The general to the third company," the missing officer appeared from behind his company, and though he was a middle-aged man and not in the habit of running, trotted awkwardly, stumbling on his toes towards the general. The captain's face showed the uneasiness of a schoolboy who is told to repeat a lesson he has not learned. Spots appeared on his nose, the redness of which was evidently due to intemperance, and his mouth twitched nervously. The general looked the captain up and down as he came up, panting, slackening his pace as he approached. "You will soon be dressing your men in petticoats. What is this?" shouted the regimental commander, thrusting forward his jaw and pointing at a soldier in the ranks of the third company in a greater coat of bluish cloth, which contrasted with the others. "What have you been after? The commander-in-chief is expected and you leave your place, eh? I'll teach you to dress the men in fancy coats for a parade, eh?" The commander of the company, with his eyes fixed on his superior, pressed two fingers more and more rigidly to his cap, as if in this pressure lay his only hope of salvation. "Well, why don't you speak? Whom have you got there dressed up as a Hungarian?" said the commander, with his austere garb. "Your Excellency." "Well, Your Excellency what? Your Excellency. But what about Your Excellency? Nobody knows." "Your Excellency, it's the officer Dolokhov, who has been reduced to the ranks," said the captain softly. Well, has he been degraded into a field marshal or into a soldier? If a soldier, he should be dressed in regulation uniform like the others. Your Excellency, you gave him leave yourself on the march. Gave him leave? Leave? That's just like you, young men, said the regimental commander, cooling down a little. Leave, indeed. One says a word to you, and you... What? He added with a renewed irritation. I beg you to dress your men decently. And the commander, turning to look at his adjutant, directed his jerky steps down the line. He was evidently pleased at his own display of anger, and walking up to the regiment, wished to find a further excuse for wrath. Having snapped at an officer for an unpolished badge, and another because his line was not straight, he reached the third company. How are you standing? Where is your leg? Your leg! Shouted the commander, with a tone of suffering in his voice, while there were still five men between him and Dolokhov with his bluish-grey uniform. Dolokhov slowly straightened his bent knee, looking straight with his clear, insolent eyes in the general's face. Why a blue coat? Off with it! Sergeant Major, change his coat. The rat... He did not finish. General, I must obey orders, but I am not bound to endure, Dolokhov hurriedly interrupted. No talking in the ranks. No talking. No talking. Not bound to endure insults, Dolokhov concluded in loud ringing tones. The eyes of the general and the soldier met. The general became silent, angrily pulling down his tight scarf. I request you to have the goodness to change your coat, he said, as he turned away. All right, there we go. What a cool start to book two. It's kind of as I predicted in the previous chapter that we would jump straight to sort of wartime. I don't know, they're not fighting in a war. We have jumped to, you know, an army preparing to war. They've marched 700 miles, I think it said, or kilometers. And now they're kind of near the border of Austria and Germany in a place called Brunau. So we've got a bunch of new characters here, but there's only one that we recognize. Or you may have recognized. And that's Dolokhov. Dolokhov, the man whose coat is slightly too blue. And he makes the commander very, very angry. You might remember Dolokhov. He was the guy that drank a bottle of rum on the windowsill. Way back in Chapter 6, Pierre attended a party at Prince Vasily's eldest child, Anatole's house, where there was a bear that he danced with. And this character, Dolokhov, drank a bottle of rum as a dare outside, balancing on the windowsill. I remember Dolokhov was sort of described as a man who wasn't rich and wasn't royal. He wasn't a prince or anything like that. But he had a lot of respect from all the other men, despite the fact that he wasn't born into any privileged position. So it was nice to have a familiar face here, and Dolokhov with his shoddy coat. And it was also nice that he kind of, at the end there, stood up for himself. You know, he was getting yelled at. He kind of says, you can tell me that I've done something wrong, but I'm not going to put up with insults. It was quite cool. He's got some guts, this Dolokhov character, and I'm excited to see him in action. So what happened in this chapter? So this regiment has been marching for 700 miles, 20 miles of which they'd done that day, and they're not looking too great. And here they are on the outskirts of Germany. They're in Austria. They're near the border, and they hear that the commander-in-chief wants to inspect their regiment. So they stay up all night, getting themselves looking spiffy, making sure everything's perfect for the commander-in-chief, who's coming in the morning to take a look at them. Then, in the morning, they find out, with an hour to go, that the commander-in-chief actually wanted them looking shabby, because some Austrians have asked him for support in something. Find the exact details here. What did it say? It said a member of the Hofkriegsgraf from Vienna had come to Kutuzov the day before with proposals and demands for him to join up with the army of the Archduke Ferdinand and Mack, and Kutuzov, not considering this junction advisable, meant, among other arguments in support of this view, to show the Austrian general the wretched state in which the troops had arrived from Russia. So he didn't want to help out the Austrians in this particular case, so he wanted to show them that his army was, they're not up to it, they're too tired, they're too wretched, they need a chance to rest. I think that's what was happening there. So they've spent all night getting themselves spiffy, when actually the commander-in-chief wanted to show them off looking horrible. So now they've got to undo all their work and make themselves look bad again, which I guess is going to be fine because, you know, after marching all day, then staying up all night, working to make yourself look good, and then working again, double time to make yourself look bad, they're going to look pretty tired and pretty haggard. Then the commander-in-chief finds one person in one regiment who's wearing a bluish coat instead of a grey coat, and he goes to town on this one person, and that just happens to be Dolokhov, the daredevil, windowsill-sitting, rum-drinking character from Anatole's party. Now, there's a lot of sort of new characters in this chapter, and there's commander-in-chief, and there's the commander, and there's this and that, and it was all, for me, just a big confusing mess. But what I'm getting from the comments here in the subreddit is that it was a big confusing mess for everyone, and potentially that was actually Tolstoy's aim, was to keep it kind of confusing, because it's just, you know, in the masses of an army, they're just kind of faceless commander this, commander-in-chief that. The only character who I believe is named at all in this chapter is Dolokhov himself. Reddit user DeFleury said, "Maud translation, if that's what I've got here on my e-reader, sucks. Would it be cheating to just give these men some names? Surely the original Russian is not like this. I've got a general, an adjutant, a captain, a regimental commander, a battalion commander, a company commander, a commander-in-chief, and someone, or two or three someones, just called the commander. I feel like the idiot in the Who's On First sketch. I was so relieved to see Dolokhov, a familiar face." He later edited this comment to say, "On rereading, I believe there's three main characters plus the adjutant who brings the message. I really hope ranks in the Russian military isn't going to be on the test." Who Was Once Delight replied by saying, "I miss being confused by the prince and the princess already." Another Reddit user, 100157, said, "I was actually relieved that we didn't get new names. I could just observe these anonymous people without investing in them." Reddit user Quitterset said, "I regret to inform you that the original Russian is indeed precisely like this, right down to the term for several of these ranks being, even pronounced in Russian, wait for it, commander. Not a single name among them, Dolokhov aside. And it very much does read like a comedy, like Tolstoy is almost mocking the ridiculousness of all this." DeFleury replied to this comment by saying, "Thanks. The next chapter, and many helpful Redditors, reveals that general and commander-in-chief are the same person, while Austrian general, regiment commander, and captain are all someone else. So there are at least four guys in this chapter. Sigh. For the first time, I sympathise with people who fail reading comprehension and prefer to watch it on TV." Yep, it certainly was confusing, but I feel like what I'm gathering is it's like it's just one of those just power-through type of chapters. Dolokhov is the only character, it seems like, that you need to follow, you know, exactly who he is. Reddit user 100157 also says, "I liked this chapter. It felt almost like Catch-22. Turtle Vader replied saying, "I thought the exact same thing, really showing the absurdity of war. I'm glad I'm not the only one to see that." Who Was Once Delight commented to say, "I made this connection too. The ridiculousness of making the men dress up after a long march, only to change them back into their unpolished clothes, seemed like something right out of Hela. The detail about their shoes was painful. On a long march, the quality of your shoes is probably one of the only things that does matter, and it seemed like the only thing that the commander was like, "Eh, what can you do?" about. You'd think that detail would give him more anxiety than a blue overcoat, at any rate. There was another reply, by less than insightful, saying, "I'm in the army, and this chapter was particularly interesting. Some 200 years later, and I'm noticing a lot of similarities to the current commanders that I have had." I liked this chapter. I thought it was a good sort of change of pace, bringing in a new setting, bringing in a new country, and bringing the focus completely off high society Russia. I also thought it was cool to start with Dolokhov. Like, we know we're going to see a lot of these characters taken out of their element from Russia and put into a war situation, into an army military situation. And you kind of wondered where it was going to start. Was it going to start with Andrew? Was it going to start with Nicholas? Was it going to start, you know, where? And we've landed on Dolokhov, and I think that's pretty cool. That's a cool decision. It makes me very curious to read on. I also kind of immediately liked this character Dolokhov way back in chapter 6 when we met him. Seems like a bit of a natural born leader. And someone with integrity and what would be the word? Charisma, for sure. Anyway, I think we'll leave it here. Thank you very much for listening once again, and I will see you tomorrow.